Okay, it is 9:30, and we will pick up our study of Revelation again. I'll begin by expressing my appreciation to Gail for covering while I was gone for a couple weeks. He told me this morning that you can't hear.
You're on mute.
I'm on mute. Josh, can you unmute me, please? Unmute. Okay. All right, everybody can hear me now? Okay, I thought it was okay because I wasn't using the whiteboard this time. I didn't even think about muting or unmuting. Okay, so thank you, Gail, for covering for me last week. We're in the sticky part of Revelation now. This is where it gets really weird, which I kind of hated to dump those trumpets on Gail because those trumpets are some of the more difficult symbols to understand. But I think, and I was talking to Susan yesterday, and I said, I think this time going through Revelation, I kind of feel better about having a grasp of things because this time I'm really working hard to focus on the action of the book rather than getting all, why did the locusts have crowns? You know, getting all caught up in all these details. This time I'm trying to stay more focused on what's happening and in the context of the book that we've talked about. And it just seems to be fitting together better for me. And I don't know, this is like the eighth or ninth time that I've been through a study of Revelation. So maybe by time 10, I'll actually start to figure out what's going on with the book. So we'll pick up with chapter 10. So somebody tell me where we are. You know, I said it's all about action, and that's what I've been trying to do. So where are we in the action of the book? What is going on here as we resume our study in Revelation chapter 10? Anybody at home? Okay, so the book started with God on his throne, and we saw the worship and the majesty, and this is kind of section one here of your lesson, if you're wondering where I'm coming with that. We had the throne scene and the glory of God, the power and the majesty of God, and a reminder to the audience of Revelation of who their God was, what their God was, who they were choosing. We keep coming back to this point because I think this is the fundamental underpinning of Revelation. What choice are you going to make? You can choose God, or you can choose to try to get along with, in this case, Rome, or in a larger context, if we want to make a universal application, the world. But that's really what the gospel is about. Choose God or the world. That's really what a Christian life is about. We make our decision. We're choosing between God and the world. So the book begins with, hey, let's not forget who and what God is. And we've got the throne scene, and we've talked about that. Then we have the Lamb, and the Lamb is introduced, and his redeeming work, and he's praised, and he's honored. And what is the Lamb able to do that no other being in creation can do? Yeah, we had the scroll, seven seals, and only the Lamb is found in all creation able to open these seals. So we started opening the seals, and we've gone through each one of those, and we got to the seventh seal week before last. And when the seventh seal was broken, there what appeared to John? It's not a trick question. Yeah, seven trumpets. And then, so Revelation is, and Gail and I talked about this before class, the organization of the book. You have the scroll. And we talked about the scroll being God's will. But God's will needed to be executed. Those seals needed to be broken. And Christ was the one to execute his will. And if you remember back in that lesson, I said that our approach in this class was going to be that was God's plan for this conflict that these Christians who are being written to, because we need to keep that in sight to keep from getting all twisted up in some of the different interpretations of these symbols in Revelation. We need to keep the audience in sight. That seal was God's plan for dealing with this conflict between Rome and the church, between Satan with Rome as his agent and the church. Now, there are larger applications that we can make throughout history, just like any other book in the Bible. You know, we can take principles that we find in Revelation, but I think the context of Revelation, we need to stay firmly focused on Rome. That kind of keeps us out of the, oh, well, the locusts were, or the star falling from heaven was a nuclear holocaust that some people have posited, because that just, we're just, you avoid all that if you say we're going to stay within this conflict between the church and Rome, Satan, with Rome as its agent. So if that's the scroll, we see these seals begin to be broken, and we went through that. And then the seventh seal, there's kind of a pause. And I know Gail talked about this in his lesson. There's this silent moment. What does silence do generally? I mean, what's our psychological reaction to silence?
Kind of
like
going on.
You start to listen, don't you? If things get quiet, what do? You start looking around to see why are things getting quiet. It's ironic, isn't it, that quiet gets your attention? And I was able to listen to that lesson. I know Gail said, I'm not going to belabor that point. But the seventh seal begins with a period of silence. To me, that suggests that things are coming to a head. The culmination is coming. You know, all these things have transpired one after another, after another, after another. But then when we get to the seventh seal, there's this moment of kind of focus, silent, you know. And then we see these seven trumpets. And then we go through, and Gail has gone through the seven trumpets. And I know y'all have talked about that these are partial judgments, because in each case it's a third, a third, a third, a third. It's not the whole. I was not able to listen to last week's lesson, but did y'all talk about how there was kind of a progression through the trumpets? I mean, it was the earth, and then it was the sea, and then it was the water, and then it was the heaven. But by the time you get to trumpets 5 and 6, now what is being affected by these judgments? People. In the fifth trumpet, it says that people are tormented by these locusts that come out, and they're have stings like scorpions, and it's torment. But then by the sixth trumpets, what's happening to people? When this armies from the east, which interestingly enough, the beginning of this interlude in chapter 7, remember the four angels that we said, and they were being held back while the people of God were marked or sealed? This army of the east, that's the four angels. They're finally released. You know, so this period of waiting that, you know, it wasn't just wait for the sealing, but again, the deliberateness of God's execution. You know, all these other trumpets need to be blown, but by the sixth trumpet, now it's time, and those angels are released. And they turn into or become this army that... But what happens under the sixth trumpet that hasn't happened up till now? Yeah, people are dying. So there's a progression. Now, again, these are symbols. Okay, and I'm going to keep coming back to this statement. I can't remember if it's, I think it's out of Jim's lesson material. Revelation is not trying to describe anything. It's trying to impart ideas. So if you get caught up in why they were locusts instead of wasps, or you get caught up in why the armies came from the east instead of the west, that it's not a physical description. So these people, there's no recorded history where a 2 million-man army marched out of the Euphrates Valley and put a bunch of Roman citizens to death. That's not because it's not literal. But people are dying. I think it's not so much the idea of people physically dying. It's the progression of the severity of the judgments that you're seeing. All coming to a crescendo, if you will, with the seventh trumpet. The seventh trumpet of the seventh seal. Did you have a comment, Aki? I see you raise your hand. Did you want to say something? No, not you. One of Gail's grandkids.
She was trying to figure out if she was on the TV.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't want to ignore anybody, but that's fine. Yeah, TVs are fun, aren't they? So that's kind of where we are. So now, beginning with chapter 10, and this is another thing that I know I've addressed before, I'm going to keep coming back to it, the organization of Revelation. I'm an engineer by inclination, by training. I tend to go A, B, C, D. That's very much a Western European mindset. That's not how this book is written, and that's not how Eastern cultures tend to think anyways. So Revelation is full of what Jim used to call pullover and park moments, where you've got this message, you've got this theme being presented, and then it's like, okay, let's leave that for a moment and consider this. So when you start trying to, well, this happened before that, you can get yourself twisted up really quickly with the book. I will submit that chapter 10 is one of these kind of pullover and park moments, because we've got this action. The seals are being opened. The trumpets are being blown. I know Gail talked about the three woes that were pronounced at the end of chapter 8. And here in verse 12 of chapter 9, the first woe is past. Behold, two more are coming. So there's this action that's going on. But in the middle of that, we have chapter 10, where there's kind of a break in the action, if you will. And it's a different topic being considered. So what do we see in chapter 10? In the vision, what does John see?
Very strong, big, mighty angel.
Okay. Okay. And that phrase, a strong angel, have we seen that before? Back in chapter 5, I think it was. Is it chapter 5? Yeah, verse 2. A strong angel proclaiming. Now again, just as an example of getting caught up in details, I was reading some stuff earlier this week about, oh, well, you know, this is a strong angel. And it's, you know, whatever that is, it was the same class or hierarchy of the angel in chapter 5. And then there's another strong angel that we'll get to in chapter 18. And then it was like a whole page of hierarchy of, that is getting way, way too deep into the details. Whatever this being was, he was mighty. I think it's just that sound. Now, there may be different class, and it may be that there's a certain rank of angels, and the one in chapter 5 that was asking who could take the scroll and break the seal is in the same, it was of this, I don't know, and I don't care, because it doesn't matter. It's just a good example of how people get caught up in the details. The action is that this angel appears, and John looks at him, and whatever the specific details of his appearance are, John recognizes that this is a strong angel. This is a being of might and power. And how is he described in verse 1? He's clothed with what? Clothed in a cloud.
Rainbow.
He has a rainbow upon his head, face like sun, and feet like fire. Does anybody hear echoes of the description of Jesus from chapter 1 in that? It's not exact. It's not exact. But the idea of brilliance and mighty feet in chapter 1, I think his feet are like brass. Here, they're fire. The rainbow, have we seen a rainbow before? Where do we see a rainbow?
Chapter 4 at the throne.
Yeah, right around the throne. So the idea is that this being has divine accessories, for lack of a better word, divine attributes. One thing I thought was interesting, and this is not me, this is Homer Haley. He points out in his commentary that in the New Testament, wherever things are, with the exception, I think he said there were three places where clouds were literally clouds. But usually when something is mentioned as being associated with clouds, it's usually divinity or divine, the deity, and more often than not, in some form of judgment. Or divine expression of will. For example, on the Mount of Transfiguration, the voice came from a cloud. I think in Luke 21:27, Jesus says they'll see the Son of Man coming in a cloud, and the idea is judgment. So the idea of the cloud being divine expression of will, this being that John sees is operating with the authority of God, at the authority of God, I think is the meaning of those symbols, the rainbow. And I think the connections there, the similarity in the description of this being to the Christ. Now, some people will argue that this is literally Jesus speaking. I think that's a little bit of a reach, but it doesn't fundamentally change the point of the vision. So if you're more comfortable thinking that this is Jesus, you know, that's fine. I don't think you can say, no, Jesus is the Lamb. Oh, no. Jesus is the white rock. Jesus could be all those things because these are symbols representing things. They're not, you know, there's not literally a lamb and a horse and a angel. So, again, I think that's splitting hairs. This is a being operating at the authority of Christ, at the very least, at the will of God. So he comes down, and what does he have in his hand? He has a scroll, a book. And how is it described?
It's open. Little and open.
Okay, it's open, yes, but even before that. It's a little book. It's a little bit. And this is the second book that we see in Revelation, the first book being the scroll in the hand. And you kind of get the impression, because that was written front and back, and I don't know. I went back and read it again. I don't think the language explicitly says it, but I just kind of, in my mind, the picture of that is that's a big scroll. This is a little scroll. And as John pointed out, it's open. So by a scroll being open, what is implied by that? I think a couple of things are implied by that. Okay, it's meant to be read, and if read, then understood or revealed. And it's also ready to be implemented. Because we said in the scroll in chapter 5, that it was sealed up because somebody needed to break the seals to execute what was in that scroll. Well, this scroll is already open. And I think that fits with the action as we go on. So he has this little book in his hand. It's open. And he stands with his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land. And, you know, the best explanation I've heard of that, and I don't see why it would be inconsistent, is, and we use similar term, when we say, send the news out over land and sea, what do we mean? Everywhere. I mean, and I think it's that. Now, again, you have to be careful about that because we're taking our expressions and applying them to a book that wasn't written for us or by us. But I think the basic principle, I think, you know, we understand as human beings that the whole world pretty much boils down to land and sea. So if we say it includes land and sea, it's everything. So this message here is, It's not a little book because it's limited in scope or narrow in its focus. It's broad. Now, again, context. Many commentators take that and they say, okay, this is the whole world for all history. That's, again, we're stepping out of our context. I think a better interpretation to remain consistent is this is the Roman Empire as a whole. Meaning it's not just going to affect a piece of the Roman Empire. It's not going to be limited. What this little book, what this angel is going to be discussing is broad in its application to this conflict between Satan's agent Rome and the church. Because again, when you start to, and that's one thing, I mean, I love my commentaries from Haley and Harkrider, but they both tend to, every now and then, because they both in the opening introductions and everything, make the case for keeping this in context, and then every now and then they just leave all that behind and start talking about the history since the establishment of the church and the ultimate. And it's like, all those things are true, all those things are taught in Scripture. I don't know that all those things are necessarily taught in Revelation. So while I don't dispute the things that some people say about, you know, God's judgments are going to be on the whole world, no one's going to be excused, I agree with all that. But in the book of Revelation, I think we need to keep it confined to Rome, to the context of the book. So this land and sea is representing what this angel is about to say is all of Rome. I'm not just going to snip off a little piece of Rome, but he's talking about Rome in its entirety. He cries out with a loud voice, and it's described as a lion roaring. I don't know. Is anybody here? I know, Gail, you've been in Africa. Has anybody here actually heard a lion roar in the night, or even at the zoo? But in the night, yes. Do you just like, oh, a lion? Is that the reaction to that? It gets your attention. I mean, I've never heard that in real life. I mean, I've heard recordings and stuff, but I can't imagine that that's the kind of thing that you would just kind of shrug off if you heard, especially if you heard it outside the tent. I think it's the idea of, A, lion power, but also the idea of getting attention. And we've made that point several times because ultimately that's what this book is. This book is trying to get Christians' attention. trying to make them understand the truth here, because they need to understand that because of what's going on and what's going to be going on, and the strength that they're going to need to endure that. That's what this book is meant to impart. And again, the context is Rome and the first century Christians, well, first and second century Christians, but in like every other book, there are principles in here for us today. So there are things in this book that we need to pay attention to. So we see trumpets, and we see thunderings, and we see voices like lions. And when we see those things, they're meant, what's coming is about to be important. And it's important for us to pay attention to and to understand. So he speaks, or he cries out with a loud voice as a lion. And when he cried out, he's answered by... he's answered by thunder. Thunders. Yeah, and it says seven thunders. Now, again, we keep coming back to numbers aren't necessarily numbers. Is it literally seven different voices like thunder, or is it seven as the perfect divine expression of God's voice? Thunder is not an unfamiliar representation to a Bible scholar, is it? I mean, what do... when the Bible talks about thundering, what is usually in view?
The power of God.
Power of God, and more specifically, the voice of God. And probably most, the one that jumps to mind most quickly is Sinai. It says that Moses spoke and God answered him with thunder, to the point that the people were terrified of the mountain. So... again, we don't have to go very far abroad. This angel speaks with the voice of a lion and is answered with the voice of thunder. Again, I think the idea is just like the accessories that he's given, the rainbow and the face shining like the sun. It's the idea of he's speaking with divine authority. He speaks, thunder answers. Moses spoke and God answered in thunder. Moses was being given authority by God. So what this angel is about to do, what this angel is about to reveal, is with the full authority and backing, if you will, of God. This is an interesting note, and I'm not going to say anything. I really am interested in what y'all think about this. In verse 4, when the seven peals of thunder had spoken, I was about to write and heard a voice from heaven saying, seal up the things which the seven peals of thunder have spoken and do not write them. Now, wait a minute. I thought this book was called the Revelation. And yet here John says, I heard something and I started to write it down, because if you go back to chapter 1, that's what his charge was in this book, was write down these things that must shortly come to pass. Remember, now he's trying to do that. He's trying to fulfill his charge, and he's told, don't write that down. What's going on? How does this fit in the purpose and context of the book of Revelation? Is there any comfort in knowing that there were things that were said to John that he was told not to reveal? Let me back that up a sec. Are there any precedents for this, for truths being revealed or truths being witnessed by an inspired prophet of God who's told, seal that up?
Yeah, Daniel and also Paul.
Okay. Paul mentions his...
heaven, he saw things that is not lawful to utter.
Okay, very good, very good. I was thinking of Daniel, but you're absolutely right. Paul had a similar experience. Okay, so what do we do with that? Because that's happening here again with John. John heard something, obviously understood what was said, because he was getting ready to write it down and then was told, don't write that down.
You don't need to know.
Okay, okay, yeah. Ultimately, that's where, if it was important, it would have been revealed. No. No, that's not the way to... not that it's not important. But if it was necessary for us to understand, it would have been revealed. Shannon, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the end of John, the book of John, talking about there are so many more things that could have been written that are not written down.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, and that's a good point too. I mean, every detail of Jesus is like, it's just not feasible to know every, you know, and sometimes people get caught up in that. What was Jesus like as a little boy? Don't need to know. So, you know, so, Gail?
McQuiggan takes the position that, these are other methods of judgment God has in his arsenal to use.
Okay.
He's talked about some of these, but he's not revealing all that he can do with this. So, I always like that.
Okay. No, I actually, and I think Haley takes a similar position, and I like that. It's because, again, trying to stay focused on our context, why would it, how could it have been encouraging, strengthening, comforting to New Testament Christians who were undergoing this persecution to know that there were things said to John that they weren't necessarily privy to? Well, it's because, hey, look at all these things God is doing. Look at all these judgments that we're in the middle of being rendered, these partial, for now, judgments. And yet, God hasn't shown his whole playbook. You know, we talk about that in football, right? You know, you play a team that's not that good, you don't want to show your whole playbook, because you don't want to give the other teams a chance to see all the plays that you have, all the arrows in your quiver. I think that's kind of the idea here, or at least there's comfort in that. With everything that's being revealed in this book, John's saying you don't even know all of it, because God's power is so much more than even what I've been able to reveal here. So if you're worried about, again, going back to that choice, if you're worried about what Rome can do to you, and what God can do for you, you don't know the half of it, I think is the idea here in these, in this command to not reveal the utterances of the seven. And that's as far as we can really go, because again, there are people who are not afraid to start speculating about what those seven thunders said. But the writer of the book, the Spirit inspiring, said you don't need to know that. And I think even in telling us we don't need to know that, there's comfort and strength that's intended to be imparted by that. And I think that's, we cannot fathom everything that God can do for his people. And the other thing that you see throughout the Old Testament, certainly, is people who set themselves to defeat God, God uses their actions to accomplish his purpose. You know, Satan entered, is how it's described, entered Judas. Satan got to Judas, however, and again, you can read lots of arguments about what Judas may have been thinking, but the scriptures are clear that Satan influenced Judas to betray Christ, and may have been thinking, oh, hey, I know what to do about this situation. I'll get that guy killed, and then I'll win. And God used that to accomplish his purpose. And I, one thing I very clearly remember Jim in times past about this, he said, what Revelation teaches is that you can be a tool of God or you can be a servant of God. Either way, God's purposes are accomplished. The difference between a tool and a servant is cared for and rewarded, and a tool is discarded when its purpose is done. Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Alexander the Great, all those things that Daniel prophesied about, they came and they went. They served God's purpose and then they were discarded. Versus men like Daniel, servants of God, who hear all these assurances of victory. Remember the epistles? How many times, to him who overcomes, I will give this, or this, or this, or this. All these promises made. That's what Revelation is urging its listeners to do, is be servants of God. Not because God's will isn't going to be accomplished, but because God wants you to serve him willingly so that he can care for you and provide for you and give you all these things that are being promised here, all the care and all of the rewards. Remember a couple of chapters ago, the multitude rejoicing in heaven? And we said that was not necessarily a picture of heaven, but that was God's victorious people. And the scene with the waving of the palms and the praising and all being together around the throne, that's what the servants of God have to look forward to. The tools of God, in this case, some of these forces that we'll see as we go on to the book that set themselves against God, God is using them for his purpose, but their ends are not. They don't end up celebrating around the throne with palm branches. Okay, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, which is hard not to do in this particular book. So returning to the angel, he's standing on the scene. He lifts up his right hand to heaven, which, again, one of those kind of common threads, we do that too. You know, when we hold up our right hand, what are we doing?
Taking an oath.
Taking an oath, but also, you know, saying this is true, basically. We're trying to emphasize the truth or the genuineness of what we're about to say. So and in this case, it is literally making an oath, because it says in verse 8, he swore by him who lives forever, by the Creator. And we know from chapter 4's description, that's talking about the one on the throne. So he's making this oath by the one on the throne. Again, I think you've got that connection. He spoke, answered with thunder. He had the rainbow about his head. This is this angel speaking for God. So what he's saying is the word of God. Just like the scroll that was handed to the Lamb and it was the will of God, what this angel is about to say is a pronouncement from God and should be taken as that. Because people of faith know that when God says something, what happens? Whatever it was he said, it happens. So he makes this oath and he says, there shall be delay no longer. This is the end of chapter or verse 6. There shall be delay no longer, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, then the mystery of God is finished as he preached to his servants, the prophets. So there is no delay. What's that say to us? Yeah, it's coming. Okay. You remember in the opening of the sixth seal, we saw the fifth seal. We saw the altar and the souls of the martyrs, and they were told to what? Wait. There was a time, but now we're approaching, because things are transpiring, and like I said, I think what we're seeing here is kind of a culmination of the vision. The seventh trumpet, the end is coming, and it's not way, way off anymore either. Not that it was way, way off even with the fifth seal, but the time is at hand. Context. Why would that be important? Why is that statement important to a first century Christian reading these things?
Not theoretical
here. Right. It's not like the prophets of old that had to wait and long to look in the... These things are going to happen, and they're going to happen soon. That's been the theme of the whole book from the very first chapter. Things that will shortly come to pass. Things that must happen soon. So what is not going to be delayed, according to the oath that this angel is swearing? He says, first and foremost, the sounding of the seventh trumpet, I think. When he says in verse 7, the voice of the seventh angel, I think, is a reference to the sounding of the seventh trumpet, which happens just another page or two over. But what does he identifying, because this is going to help us next week when we're looking at the seventh trumpet and trying to interpret the seventh trumpet. What does this angel identify the voice of the seventh angel sounding to be? The completion of God's mystery. Okay, so what is that? What mystery are we talking about that's going to be complete with the sounding of the seventh trumpet? Okay.
I agree.
Now, again, and like I said, I love my commentaries from both Harkrider and Haley, but they both go beyond. They start talking about this is the conflict of God with world powers throughout history. You know, again, context. The mystery of God. When that phrase is used elsewhere in the New Testament, what are we usually talking about? Okay.
Which was the fulfillment of the prophecy of Abraham.
Okay. God's redeeming work is completed in Christ. And I think that's consistent here. I think that's what's in view here. Now, is the church already established? Yes. So in what sense is he saying when this seventh angel's, when the seventh trumpet is sounded, that mystery is complete? Okay, and I think that causes some confusion for some people, because we talk about God's phrase is escaping me. But God's redeeming plan, it was culminated in Christ. Well, it was. Christ made it possible. But that plan extended beyond the time that Christ was on the earth, because we have Pentecost and we have the establishment of the church and we have the Church of Jerusalem, and then it spreads to Samaria and around, and then it eventually spreads until finally, before the New Testament is complete, the statement is made, it's been preached to every creature. Well, that continued beyond Christ in the sense of the time of it being accomplished. But Gail mentioned Daniel 7 and also Daniel 9. Daniel's prophecy, especially in chapter 9, goes beyond Christ's death on the cross. Because, and we've talked about this a couple of years ago, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem is in view, and the throwing down of the power that destroys the temple in Jerusalem is in view in Daniel 9. Then you go back to Daniel 7, and you had the fourth world kingdom, and the Son of Man appears and is given a kingdom, and the little horn in the beast oppresses the same. And at the end of chapter 7, what happens of Daniel? Yeah. The beast is judged, the little horn is cast down, and the saints of God receive the kingdom. Okay? Now, the temptation is to take chapter 7 and put that at Pentecost, but I don't think that's consistent. What we have here is the fledgling kingdom, if you will, the early days of the kingdom. If there was ever a time that Satan was going to stop or destroy God's kingdom, it was now. Because it was still fairly... I mean, what do you do when you find mold in your house? Do you wait? Give it a couple years to... You try to get it wise, or a more serious, you know, when they find cancer and the doctor says, well, it's good because we caught it early. Well, why? Well, because it's still small, still contained. It hasn't spread. It hasn't got its legs underneath. If Satan was going to destroy the church, Rome was his best shot. What this book is about, what the prophecy of Daniel 7 is about, is that's not going to happen. Even going back to Daniel 2, the rock that was cut from the mountain without hands spread to fill the whole earth. And the statue, the four world powers that were in place before that happened, were gone and broken and rendered unto dust, but the kingdom was going to remain. So we already know the outcome of this, but the fulfillment. So this is what I take the seventh trumpet to be. It's the tying up of the last loose end. The only Old Testament prophecy that hasn't been finished by the time Revelation is working. By the time Revelation is written, is Daniel 7. I think all, like Tom said, all the prophecies on Isaiah, all the prophecies, all the messianic prophecies, those were all fulfilled. The light shining unto the Gentiles, that's been fulfilled. Everything the Old Testament prophesied by 96 AD has been fulfilled, except Daniel 7. Because we still haven't seen the casting down of the fourth beast, the little horn that's oppressing the saints of the Most High. That hasn't happened. That's what Revelation is about. And we've made that connection throughout this class, that Daniel 7 is kind of the cliff notes of the book of Revelation. So I think, now again, you go read some of the different commentaries out there, and they want to take that mystery and apply it in all different ways. But to stay consistent with Rome versus the church, this is the culmination of all prophecy, which the last bit was that this fourth world empire is going to try to destroy the church, and it's going to fail. And that's what's happening now when this book is written. That's what these Christians that this book is written to are going through right now. This is a reminder of the outcome has already been decided. And this angel is swearing an oath that these things are going to take place now. There will be no delay. So when people take this and start trying to apply it to 1986 or 2027 or whatever, that's not what this angel is swearing. And he's not just saying, hey, this is what he's swearing by the throne of the Creator himself. There will be no delay. So this is all going to be wrapped up soon. And I think, again, that's because what it's talking about is this conflict between Rome and the church. Verse 8, the voice which I heard from heaven, I heard again speaking with me, go take the book which is open in the hand of the angel who stands on the sea. So John is now, up until now, John has kind of been a observer. And there's been some interaction. He's been asked some questions. He's had a chance to ask some questions. But now John is kind of being drawn into the action. So he's instructed to go take the book. And when he goes to the angel in verse 9 and asks for the book, the angel replies to him, "Take it and eat it. It will make your stomach bitter. In your mouth it will be sweet as honey." That sounds kind of strange, doesn't it? I mean, generally that's not what you do with scrolls or books. I think in Jim's note he points out similar language is used in Ezekiel when God gives Ezekiel his message to preach, to proclaim, and he says its words will be as honey in your mouth but will sour your stomach. So I think the idea is, in the idea of eat is internalization. I think the way Jim phrased it in his notes was mastering the understanding of what. And we said in the presentation of this scroll, it's open. It's not sealed. It's meant to be understood. And it's meant to be executed, if you will. So John is given this little book and told to eat it, or to, I would say, understand it, to internalize it. In what sense do you think, because John says that in fact happened. In verse 10, he says, "I ate it and it was sweet as honey, but when I had eaten it, my stomach was made bitter. And they said to me, 'You must prophesy again concerning many peoples and nations and tongues and kings.'" So let's just touch briefly on the sweetness and the bitterness. How could this have been sweetness? Hang on a second, let me back up a second. What was this book? From verse 11, what was this book? Eat it, John, and then what? Prophesy. So this was a book of this was a message. And again, I think that's consistent with Ezekiel. God is giving John, here, take this, because you're going to have to, you've got more prophecy to do. And the fact that he says, you must prophesy again, I think this is either a sequential. This is like the next chapter. This is a continuation of prophecy, or it's a different prophecy. But John has been prophesying in the sense that he's been writing all this down as he was commanded to in chapter 1. Now he's given this little book and he's told, you've got more to do. You must prophesy again. So this little book is a prophecy. Now next week we'll talk some more about what we think the particular prophecy is. But it's a prophecy. It's the word of God that John is being given, just like Ezekiel. Take it, eat it, internalize it, understand it, and then do what with it? Put it out there. So John says, this receiving this prophecy, and along with it, the charge to prophesy, he says, it was sweet like honey in my mouth, but bitter in my stomach. So how would that have been sweet to John?
Sweet in the sense that maybe it came from God.
Okay. Okay.
Bitter in the sense maybe it's a difficult message to deliver, or perhaps the real meaning of that prophecy and the destruction it might entail to some extent could be difficult as well.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that's exactly right because that's exactly what Ezekiel went through when the same language was used to describe it. Sweet in the sense that God is giving me work to do. I have an opportunity to serve God in a very specific, personal capacity. I'm being given God's word, which, you know, you go back to Psalm 119. If there's one thing that distinguishes God's people of faith is their love for his word. And here John is being given a portion of his word. He's been given an opportunity to serve God. Also, just God's word, you know, and the justice, the righteousness of his word should be pleasing to us, you know, to have the opportunity to encounter. So I think that, you know, maybe the idea of satisfaction or vindication, God is revealing to John more about this conflict. And we already know from Daniel 7 how this conflict's going to come out. I think maybe the idea of, hey, that's my God. Look what he's about to do. You know, and this is being revealed to John. And there could be satisfaction, vindication in those things being revealed to God. Maybe God is giving John more details about what the end of chapter 7 of Daniel is going to look like. So so all those things I think factor into this was pleasing to John to receive this word. But on the other hand, as Nate pointed out, the things in that book may be difficult to accept. You know, well, why do people have to? Why would people do this? You know, why are things going to be that bad for God's people? And there are, as we go through the rest of the book, we're going to see God's people are suffering now. Now in the where we are in the book, you know, we've already talked about the different horses and the suffering that was going to be entailed, and that can be difficult to accept, especially when it's being revealed by God that this is what's going to happen. You know, you can try to think, oh, there's a way, I'll find a way to get along with this. God's saying no, you have to make a choice, and if you make the right choice, it's going to hurt. It's going to cost you in some way, and that can be hard. Also, there's going to be a lot of destruction. There's already been a lot of destruction. We've seen the locusts tormenting men. We've seen the armies from the east killing men. We've seen the rider of the red horse and the bloodshed that he was commanded or given authority to execute. That's not a pleasant message to contemplate or to deliver. Not only for, I think, John as a person, you know, and the compassion that John Frawley felt for the suffering of certainly his fellow Christians, but also we're supposed to have compassion on the suffering of those who haven't found the wisdom to accept God's will yet. So there's that, but also the reaction that John's likely to get as he pronounces judgment upon the ruling world empire. You know, so and again, that goes back to Ezekiel. Ezekiel's, some of the bitterness that Ezekiel experienced was God said, yeah, they're not going to listen. You know, and they're going to harden their hearts and they're going to harden their heads, but I'm going to make your head harder. But they're not going to listen. And the discouragement, all those things. So I think probably that's a fair description of any of God's prophets. Certainly Jeremiah struggled with at some points in his life, he struggled with the mission that he had been given to do, even though he was serving God and I think rejoiced in his opportunity to serve. Moses struggled at times. You know, Moses, who spoke with God, God said, I spoke with him face to face, and he even struggled at times. So John is given this book, and just in the last couple of minutes, going back to the idea of organization, the way that I look at Revelation is that the seven trumpets completes the prophecy of the seven seals. The scroll has been opened at this point. The seven trumpets have been sounded, and here with this oath of this angel, he's saying the mystery is completed. Starting in really chapter 12, there's a new sequence of visions. Still the same topic. It's still the conflict between God's church and Satan with Rome as his agent. I think it gets more specific. It's more directly applied to Rome itself. Whereas before, it's been the persecuting power, which was Rome, but it's been spoken in more general terms. In the rest of the book, we're going to see the beast from the sea and the beast from the earth, and we're going to talk about how that represents or that fits with Rome's secular power and their pagan worship, emperor worship, all that. But I think we'll see more specific symbols that are more clearly pointed at Rome itself, although I think Rome's been in sight all along. I think that's what the little book is. It's the rest of this, because it fits within the larger context of the big scroll. But now John is being given a revelation of these things that are going to be unmistakably Rome. And the seven bowls I see as part of that. I know other commentaries, and Gail told me that that's kind of how he laid it out last week. I don't object to that, because I think you arrive at the same place. But the other way people look at this is that the next several chapters are a continuation of the seven seals. So you've got seven seals, and then the seventh seal has seven trumpets, and then the seventh trumpet has seven bowls. And the bowls are a more complete judgment than the trumpets were. And I think all that's fine. The one thing I do like about that is we've talked about in here before about how when something needs to be emphasized, it's repeated three times. There's three woes. The living creature said, holy, holy, holy. Well, if you take that organization, you've got seven, or you've got three sevens. You've got seven seals, seven trumpets, seven bowls. Either way, God's going to win over Rome. And the encouragement and the comfort that's being, however you choose to organize it. To me, it just seems to fit a little bit better if the seven bowls are part of this prophecy revelation that's contained in this little book that's being given to John at this point. So I'll make my comments along those lines, but certainly if you like to think of this as being a continuation of the seventh trumpet and the up to the pouring out, I don't think that's not leading us astray at all. So next week we will pick up with chapter 11, which is kind of another one of those, hey, we're going to pull over and park for a minute, because all these things are going on with these trumpets, and it's kind of a parenthetical. But in the meantime, did y'all read comic books much when y'all were kids? You know, all this is going on, and then there's that box that says, meanwhile, and then there's a whole different sequence of events that, you know, that's kind of what chapter 11 is. And we'll talk about that with the two witnesses and the measuring of the temple. We'll talk about what that means next week. Thank you for your attention and for your comments.